This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on today's Trumpet Hour. We are ready to discuss the week in review, the most important events of this past week. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And from Edstone, our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
Well, let's get right to it. Another deadly terrorist attack this week, this one in New York City. We've been focusing on how the Islamic State is in decline, but on Tuesday afternoon, October 31st, a man pledging loyalty to this terrorist group drove a rented pickup truck onto a bike path in Manhattan and mowed down pedestrians and runners and cyclists. He killed 8 people, injured 12 more. To learn more about this story, we're going to turn to Andrew.
This was the deadliest terrorist attack in New York City since the 9/11 terrorist attack on 2001. As our most of our listeners will know, over 3,000 people died in the 9/11 attack, and there hasn't been much in the way of terrorist attacks in New York City since then, till this Tuesday when a man went to Home Depot, rented a Home Depot rental truck, like almost anyone can do. Took it out, turned it down a bike path, and ran over 23 people, killing 8 of them and injuring at least 12 more. These were running over pedestrians, running over joggers, running over cyclists, and then eventually ran into a school bus, injuring, I believe, 3 children inside of the school bus before exiting his Home Depot rental truck. And people on the site said that he was shouting Allah Akbar, waving a paint gun in one hand and a pellet gun in the other hand, until a local New York police officer shot him in the stomach. And that ended the attack. He went into a coma and underwent surgery in the hospital. But as is fairly unusual in these cases, he actually recovered and is alive now. They're beginning the questioning process for his motives. But he's stated after waking up out of his coma that he's very proud of what he did. And they found an Islamic State flag in the truck, as well as several handwritten notes pledging loyalty to the Islamic State.
So what do you make of this, or what do officials make of the connections to this terrorist group? How strong were they? How much direction did he receive from them, or how much does that even matter as we're seeing this terrorist group kind of fade from relevance in some ways?
Well, yeah, and definitely in some ways ISIS is fading from relevance, and then in other ways is actually becoming more dangerous. And I guess what I mean by that is it is obviously the Islamic State is losing a lot of territory in the Middle East. As we've mentioned before on this program, Iran is stepping up and filling the void in Iraq and in Syria. And so ISIS is kind of shifting strategies, and they notice they don't if they're not putting their resources into fighting losing battles in Syria, they're starting to encourage more foreign attacks overseas in places like Europe and America. And this is obviously a very decentralized model compared to some of the more centralized terrorist groups like Hezbollah. But this man, he was from Uzbekistan, immigrated to the United States on a diversity visa in 2010. Right now, authorities are thinking that he was radicalized by the Islamic State after he moved to the United States, just by reading stuff online. And so it's kind of something where I doubt highly that he's like on a payroll or taking a logistic chain of command from the higher ups in ISIS. But he has gotten online, found out this group's perverse worldview, been inspired by it. Recently, the Islamic State published a manual on how to conduct terrorist attacks using a rental truck. no word on if he's seen that manual, but that's kind of the type of things you're dealing with, is just any Islamic radical who wants to lash out against the great Satan can pick up online manuals online on how to do something like this and kind of act on their own.
So obviously something like this gets a lot of headlines, and there are a lot of recriminations and politicians saying, well, we need to do something to stop these attacks and so on. But put this in context for us. We've been talking, Stephen Fleury talked about this on his Trumpet Daily radio show last Friday, and we've talked about it a bit since then, just the difference between the Islamic State and the threat that it poses relative to the number one state sponsor of terror, Iran.
Right, and that is kind of one of the main differences. The Islamic State, obviously, it, as our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has brought out before, and I think in his article, The Sudden Whirlwind, it doesn't really even have an air force. Its military model is very decentralized. It's losing ground in the Middle East, so it's not really a threat against the American nation like someplace like Iran is. It's more of a threat in just its ability to inspire lone wolf and small terrorist attacks like this one that can take a couple dozen lives several times throughout the year. And we'll be talking a little later in this program about just Iran's role and even funding groups like this, in funding Al-Qaeda, which is Iran's Shiite, Al-Qaeda Sunni, in funding the Taliban, and in some cases even funding the Islamic State. I know the Egyptian branch of the Islamic State's got quite a bit of funding from Iran, and there's been no connection drawn so far between Iran and this particular terrorist, other than Iran has been funding groups that are spewing this type of violent rhetoric against the West, which can radicalize someone like this.
So what has been the political response to this in the United States?
It's pretty close to what you'd expect. I mean, I think the mayor of New York took the more standard, be proud, be New Yorkers, live your life exactly how you lived your life yesterday. Don't change anything. Otherwise, the terrorist wins somehow angle. While President Trump and some of the more like nationalistic voices in the Republican Party talked more about how this man came here on a diversity visa from Uzbekistan. And we need to do away with that program and really clamp down on making sure that immigrants from some of these radical Islamic countries don't come here anymore. We'd really just like to point our audiences to a prophecy in Leviticus 26. Our longtime listeners will know that the Americans and the British people are actually descended from the ancient Israelites. And for those who haven't proved that, you can request Herbert W. Armstrong's free booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. But in that Leviticus 26, it's really kind of the pivotal prophecy for the nations of Israel, where God made a covenant with them saying that if you obey my laws and keep my statutes, I'll bless you with good weather, and I'll bless you with national greatness, and I'll bless you with agricultural prosperity, and I'll bless you with peace and safety. But if you disobey, there's going to be weather disasters and lawlessness and economic problems and terrorism. I think the way the verse words it is, he said, I'll appoint over you terror. Mm-hmm. And this is and so this is actually like even a promise from God that is like, if you break this covenant you've made and you start disobeying, that's going to be the natural result of it, is terrorism's going to occur. And so the politicians, they can talk about restricting immigration, and they can talk about giving a bigger budget to Homeland Security, and they can talk about a lot of measures. And I mean, not all of those are bad ideas, but the fact remains is if there's national sins, sins against the family, sins against morality, divorce, broken families, things like that. This is a natural curse that the Bible said would happen.
If somebody wants more information, any listeners, you can go on to thetrumpet.com. Andrew has an article there called The Islamic State Attacks New York. You can also just check the show notes for this program if you just go to the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. We'll include links to some other articles that give you more context of this prophecy that Andrew is talking about there in Leviticus 26. Very important prophecy to look at. We appreciate that, Andrew. As he said, later in the program, we're going to talk about new evidence of Iran's support for another major terrorist group. Right now, we're going to look at just how extensive Iran's activity is, specifically in North Africa. Very interesting comments from some North African leaders this week, reported by Reuters, warning about this troubling trend, and one that we at the Trumpet have been warning about for well over two decades. For this, we'll turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, this is a really interesting piece that featured the leader of Morocco, a couple of his quotes, and also some other North African leaders as well. And it was published in Reuters earlier this week. And it was entitled, "In Sunni North Africa, Fears of Iran's Shiite Shadow." Now, this really just captured my attention immediately, seeing that because of what biblical prophecy says Iran is going to do in North Africa. But we can talk about that a little bit later. I do want to go through some of these quotes of these North African leaders that see Iran moving into their domain. There was a Islamist party leader from Morocco who recently warned of, quote, a sectarian Shiite invasion. And then there was the Grand Mufti of Mauritania. He called on his country's leaders to resist, quote, the rising Shiite tide. And then another North African government minister that was interviewed for The Peace said, quote, he denounced the intrusion of Shiism through social media, university dormitories, high schools, and even Quranic schools, concluding gravely, quote, "I ask myself whether the Persians want to dominate the Arab world." And so you've got African leaders over the past, I would say past year and a half, that are noticing an influx of Iranian propaganda into their countries. That is through different Arabic television sites where there's Shiite religious programming. Also, because it's backed by the Iranian government as well, the Iranian leaders are traveling to North Africa, trying to fully invest into different business ventures or develop economic ties with North Africa. So while there hasn't been too much right now to show that Iran is trying to take over these countries, they're looking at each other and asking, what is Iran's goal in all of this? The government interference, the propaganda interference, the sponsoring of Shiite study courses throughout the North African region, and they are kind of worried. They see what Iran has done elsewhere in the Middle East, and they're asking, is North Africa next?
So the man said, "I ask whether the Persians want to dominate the Arab world." That's almost word for word what Gerald Flory said 23 years ago.
Right. There was that quote that was from a North African leader, and he's just looking at this and trying to come to terms with it. What is the goal here? And he said, do the Persians want to dominate all of us? Yes. Yeah. The answer is yes. And Bible prophecy has indicated that. And Mr. Flory has talked about that for about 20 years. Then this is a commentary piece in Reuters. And after that quote, the author, Jonathan Lawrence, he asks, after Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and Bahrain, is North Africa the next realm of a more assertive Iranian foreign policy? Now yes, it is. And we have been saying that. We've been saying that Iran has dominated these other powers in Iraq, Lebanon, now into Yemen. But we said back in 2011, or Mr. Flory said back in 2011, to watch North Africa, watch Libya, watch Egypt, because that is where Iran is going next. And then this piece comes out 5 or 6 years later and is asking that very question. We've seen them dominate other regions in the Middle East. Is the sites, or are the sites of Iran now clearly on North Africa?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I guess just the religious aspect of this is worth noting. The fact that there would be people who would question, say, that forecast that Iran would be coming after Sunni-dominated Arab states. And yet this shows that, well, that really doesn't matter, that there's a larger ideological thrust behind what Iran is doing, and a strategic thrust, a territorial and a geographic thrust.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the prophecy that we base this off in Daniel chapter 11, that doesn't refer to Shia, it doesn't refer to Sunni, it doesn't even necessarily refer to Islam. And yet from those scriptures, especially Daniel 11 and verse 40, talking about this king of the south, and then the next few verses talk about this king of the south being allied with Libya, with even Ethiopia, with Egypt. If you look at Egypt, Egypt's a heavy Sunni country. The Shia population is extremely low. If you look at North Africa, including Libya, the Shia population there is extremely low again. And Ethiopia, that's majority Christian, with different different Islamic sects there. And so just looking at the prophecy, it doesn't concern itself with this Shia, Sunni, or even partially Christian. It just says that the king of the south is going to dominate these nations. And looking at it, as you said, with this Sunni-Shia divide in mind, you would have to say that, well, people do say that that's impossible, that Iran would govern North Africa because they're Sunni. How would they do that? And yet the Bible indicates they will, specifically, definitely Libya, but also this whole coastline area over to Algeria, Tunisia, including Egypt, down through the Red Sea there. They want to dominate this area. People are looking at this and saying it's impossible. What's Iran doing? Because they're not going to sway all the Sunnis over to Shiism. But that's not their plan. They're not intending to do that. They know that that would be impossible. But what they do want is to get their voice into these nations to trumpet the fact that they aren't necessarily championing Shiism. They're championing Islam. Mm-hmm. And they could definitely gather adherents, not necessarily to Shiism, but to their version of radical Islam, political Islam, Islam that wants to dominate the world. There are many adherents in following Sunni Islam that believe that. Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, a lot of those groups, they will have that same ideology as Iran. And if they see their own governments not championing Islam as much as they want, they could be vulnerable to this message from Iran.
Where to send people for more information on this prophecy?
They can go ahead and go to thetrumpet.com, of course, and read the booklet, Libya and Ethiopia in Prophecy by Gerald Flory. I just do want to have one quote from that. It says here, this is towards the beginning of that book. It says, so you need to watch Libya and Ethiopia. Libya, for everybody, that's in North Africa, right where this Reuters piece is concerned about. And then he says, they are about to fall under the heavy influence or control of Iran. And here we have this Reuters piece saying, is this what Iran is up to?
Outstanding. Thanks for that very much. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. Last week, we talked about how Chinese President Xi Jinping has cemented his power over the nation to an extent not seen since Mao Zedong. If you want an idea of what he's going to do with that power, just look at China's ongoing militarization in the South China Sea. There's new evidence emerging this week showing that it continues to tighten its grip on these strategic waters. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, for the last several months, the world's attention has really been fixated on the North Korean crisis. And during that time, news about China's brazen behavior in the South China Sea has mostly faded from the headlines. But there were some new satellite images published this week that show that during that time, Beijing has quietly continued to increase its land reclamation in these contested waters and its militarization of the features there. This was on Tuesday, and Reuters published a pair of satellite photos of the Tree Island and the North Reef, which are both features of the disputed Paracel Island chain. The Paracel chain is claimed by China, but also by Taiwan and Vietnam. And then some sections of the chain are also claimed by the Philippines and Malaysia. So quite a few claimants there. And China's claims are actually fairly weak. But that hasn't stopped Beijing from just really asserting control over this whole island chain. So the first photo that Reuters published was taken back in November of 2015. And then the other was taken in October of this year. So that's about 23 months, almost 2 years time difference. And it's plain to see by comparing these two images that China has made considerable progress in developing its installations on these two features. Analysts believe that China is converting these into naval and air bases. And as is the case with all of the islands and other outposts in the South China Sea, China is using them to strengthen its claims over nearly that entire, very resource-rich and strategically located region. I've got a quote here from Bonnie Glaser. She's a China defense expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And she said, quote, China has built these extensive facilities, and both Chinese civilian and military experts have always made clear that when the strategic time is right, they're going to start using them more fully. I think it's a question of when rather than if China will start to assert its interests more forcefully in the South China Sea.
That's a really good point, that they're not just putting all of this up there for as a hobby. They have strong ambitions, and we can expect to see how are they going to use this in the time ahead.
That's exactly right. For quite a few years, China tried to say this is strictly for civilian purposes, but I think at this point they've abandoned even trying to make that argument because it's so obviously military in nature. So it really does, it's clear that China has benefited from that North Korean distraction. It's taken advantage of having the attention of the U.S. fixated on Pyongyang, and it's used that time to just really continue all of these provocative behaviors in the South China Sea. So it's a big story, and Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that Beijing's land reclamation and militarization in the South China Sea, quote, should alarm the world, because it means China is steering the world toward war. There's an article that he wrote in the July 2016 print edition. It's called China is Steering the World Toward War. And one part of this article says, quote, these militarized islands now function as forward bases for Beijing to challenge 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This should alarm the world, end quote. And then from there, Mr. Fleury explains that the South China Sea is one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world. About a third of the world's total maritime commerce flows through it. So it really would be a major and catastrophic loss for the U.S. and for the world if China succeeds in its goal of asserting total control over this area. And Mr. Fleury makes the case that this could very quickly lead to a trade war, which often comes just before an actual shooting war. And in his article from there explains that this provocative Chinese activity will soon contribute to the fulfillment of a Bible prophecy about modern-day America and Britain being besieged by China and other nations. Andrew mentioned Leviticus 26 earlier, and Deuteronomy 28 is kind of a sister chapter to that same passage. And Deuteronomy 28 just lists more of those curses that were prophesied to come upon the U.S. and the U.K. as a result of its disobedience. And verse 52 of Deuteronomy 28 says, and he shall besiege you in all your gates until your high and fenced walls come down, wherein you trusted throughout all your land. And so Mr. Fleury just says that China's militarization of the South China Sea is one of many areas where onlookers today can already see this prophecy in Deuteronomy 28:52 moving toward its fulfillment. So it's alarming because it is leading to a time when China and its allies will be able to control one third of the world's maritime commerce, and the U.S. will be blocked out.
Amazing. If you want more information on this, go to thetrumpet.com. Jeremiah has an article that will appear there soon. Beijing quietly ramps up militarization of South China Sea. Or you can go to the show notes of this program and get the link to that and that very important cover story from Gerald Fleury from some years ago on this that really do put it in prophetic context. Very important material there to consider in light of what's happening in the South China Sea today. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Next, we'll go to Europe. Our newest Trumpet magazine talks about the political earthquake that is shaking Germany and all of Europe, the German elections that left Angela Merkel terribly weak. We talk about how the rise of the far-right party is going to make it impossible for her to put together a strong coalition, or maybe any coalition, for quite some time. Well, it's been a month and a half since that election. How are the coalition talks going? And how is what's happening there in Germany affecting the rest of Europe? For this story, we'll turn to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yeah, they're not going well. That's probably about the most succinct way of putting it. There's been quite a few headlines this week about just how badly these are going, perhaps even more badly than some of the news commentators in Germany were expecting. These groups are from wildly different parts of the political spectrum, and that has absolutely been coming across in these negotiations. So today, there's a kind of a review. Angela Merkel is reviewing the past couple of weeks of exploratory talks, where she's been talking with these four different parties, and they are exploratory talks that are just preparing for the final for the ultimate coalition talks. So they're not even final talks yet. She's reviewing on the exploratory talks, and basically the program has not been good. I'll just read you some quotes from an article here from the local. Actually, it's from the agency France Presse. It says, threats, name-calling, and a whole lot of dramatic posturing. Talks among four fractious parties to form a new government have proven more fiery than fruitful so far. They wrote that the election seems highly uncertain. Basically, what they're doing now is they've decided they're just going to put the biggest issues in the too-hard bin. Mm-hmm. So things like environmental regulation, they've had some very angry discussions on that, and made no progress, so they're just not going to. They're going to leave them out of discussions for the next little bit. And the same with immigration. So these probably are the two biggest contention points. They've just decided we can't even talk about these. It gets too fractious. There've been the different leaders have been kind of insulting each other in the press, and it's been a mess. Mr. McDonald had an article on this published earlier in the week, so even not even taking into account some of the later stories about how badly just this week has been going on. He quoted from Deutsche Welle that talks about how these parties disagree on far more things than they agree on, and that he talks about how more and more people are asking, well, if this coalition happens at all.
Yeah, the German people have to just be horrified watching this happening.
That's right. And then as this Agency France Presse article brings out, there are high stakes here. They quote the German newspaper Die Zeit saying that if the alliance does not come together, Merkel is finished. They say that they point out that if these talks fail, there's no real plan B. There's no other coalition really that she could fall back from. I mean, some were talking about perhaps if the Christian Social Unions got rid of Angela Merkel and got a new leader, then maybe the Social Democrats would be open to talking to them. Huh. So that's probably the closest that there is to a plan B right now, and even that's a pretty radical step. Mm-hmm. But if these fail, it would be almost certainly fresh elections. They point out that this would boost the alternative for Deutschland most likely. So you could see the AfD coming back again with even more strength. And if that happened, we would be 6 months down the line or more and in exactly the same position where we are now. The odds are that, again, there'd be no obvious coalition. There'd be the same parties trying to negotiate. And Germany would just be following some of these other countries in Europe that are just stuck in repeated political limbo.
So it seems that the Trumpet edition that we put together after the German elections, in analyzing what was going to happen as a result of that election, really everything that we talked about there is even more relevant today. If somebody just picked that up and read the analysis that we have in that issue, they would get pretty well the full story of what's going on there right now. It's only become intensified. Another point that we made in that issue was just how this could affect the rest of Europe. And maybe you could just give us an idea of what else is happening and what the what's the climate like in the rest of Europe as they're watching to see how long it's going to be before Germany gets its act together.
Yeah, well, the answer to what's happening in the rest of Europe is, in some ways, nothing much. I mean, there are still crises that pop up. You've had Catalonia, and that's going through all of its various iterations. It looks like things might calm down at least until the regional elections there. But normally at this point on the show, I'm talking about, well, there's been this initiative for a European military. Mm-hmm. They've had this negotiation and they've made this radical proposal. These groups of people are meeting together to talk about having a single European leader, these kind of things. And the French president has been putting forward some ideas and did a few months ago. But everything is just kind of stuck waiting for Germany. Europe, there are events happening in Europe, but there's no initiative. The European Union isn't there initiating change. Nobody's initiating change. It's just this kind of eerie calm almost as everybody waits for Germany to get their act together because they know that nothing can really happen until that happens, especially with Europe being one of the key sticking points between the different parties. I think Emmanuel Macron doesn't want to push forward with his vision for a European superstate because he knows it's only going to make German coalition negotiations harder, right, create more opposition, etc. So Europe's just waiting for Germany right now.
Well, before we move on, it's quite extraordinary to see this happening here. I just wonder if there are any other points that you want to make in terms of more context or where to send people. It does seem like that newest Trumpet edition is certainly a very good resource to draw on. Did you have any other thoughts?
Yeah, no, just a second there about the latest Trumpet print edition. And with our new homepage, that's easier than ever to find. You just scroll down a bit. But in there, we have an article that goes on that has a very good chunk in length. I don't want to be tooting my own horn, but a good chunk in length of material on Germany's, on what Bible prophecy says about what is coming to Germany. So just going through in detail all of these prophecies in the Book of Daniel that we use, that we often refer to, but just trying to explain in a very clear fashion what's happening within Germany and where the Bible says that it's leading, because all of this is right in line with Bible prophecy. So I'd really say go back and read that Trumpet print edition, and that has the Bible prophecy and the scriptures in there that you need to understand where this is leading, because this is one of the biggest stories in the world right now. We know that the coming leader of Germany is going to have a major impact in the world. It's a story that has a lot of negative. It's a story that has a lot of hope at the end. So it's one that it's just really important to get all of that full context on. And the Trumpet print is a great place to start with that. Then we have our free booklet, A Strong German Leader, that just goes in even more detail in all of those Bible prophecies.
Outstanding, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a newly declassified CIA document showing Iran's links with Al-Qaeda, a thawing of frosty relations between China and South Korea, money troubles in America, and a spate of violence and bad behavior by roving bands of thuggish teens in the United States. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first half about how Iran is working to dominate the Arab world. Well, new evidence of that fact emerged this week, and not just from that Reuters piece, but the CIA declassified a 19-page document that exposes the extensive support that Iran provided to Al-Qaeda, the terrorist group once led by Osama bin Laden, in an effort to hurt the United States. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
So this was a document that one of the many, I think, 470,000 files that were recovered on the raid of Osama bin Laden's compound back in May 2011. And one of those documents was this previously unseen one. It's written in Arabic, but it's been translated by the Long War Journal. And it's very interesting because it talks about a longstanding relationship that Iran has had with Al-Qaeda. leading up to the September 11 attacks, even after that time as well. Now, this is really interesting, and it is something that has been out there for a while. We haven't seen it from Al-Qaeda itself, but there have been reports of this, I would say, for the past 15 years or so. There was the 2004 9/11 commission that came out and said that it looked like there were some Al-Qaeda figures that were in Iran for a time, and that they facilitated their transit in and out of Afghanistan through Iran. So we knew that there was some type of collusion between the two, yet this document goes even further. It talks about how there were numerous people from Saudi Arabia, from Al-Qaeda, that they were given everything they needed if their strikes were to be made against the United States, be it in Afghanistan, be it in Iraq as well. After the 2003 invasion, this aid, the 19 pages talks about, extends to both money, arms, also that they were going to be able to be trained by Hezbollah in Lebanon, these Sunni fighters, and then these Al-Qaeda fighters, and then sent back into the fields. So basically it indicates that if Al-Qaeda came to Iran, or they wanted to make an attack against U.S. interests, Iran would bankroll that, would bankroll that that attack.
So put this in prophetic context for us, Brent.
Yeah, well, this is very important, even as we were kind of talking about in the first half of the show, because we've long said that Iran is the king of the South, that dominates radical Islam. They bankroll radical Islamist acts through the Middle East and the world. While you might have these other Sunni groups such as Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State, when it comes down to it, these groups, and sometimes they do attack Iran, yet they are willing to work together if they have a common enemy. There is one point in this tranche of documents that were released that say that from talking about, I believe it was, yeah, it was from Osama bin Laden himself, and he cautioned other Al-Qaeda agents about being overly antagonistic towards Iran because he described Iran as Al-Qaeda's, quote, main artery for funds, personnel, and communication. That's from Osama bin Laden himself. Operatives out there, watch what you do to Iran, because they are the ones paying for our missions. A pretty big admonition from the leader of Al-Qaeda. And so that is what Iran is willing to do. Even right now, there are reports that Iran, some of the Islamic State soldiers that have been captured by the Iranians, they are saying to the Islamic State fighters, we can fund your acts of terror. If you go out and not attack us and actually be a soldier of Islam against the West, we're willing to let you go free. Now, those are not necessarily ultra-confirmed reports. I'm sure we'll see more about that in the future, but they're doing it again. Again, radical Islam, Iran is the king of radical Islam. They support Sunni groups in Iraq to attack Americans, the Taliban to attack Americans, Al-Qaeda to attack Americans, some groups in Benghazi in Libya in the past they supported to attack Americans. Iran also backed the Morsi government in Egypt financially, as that was anti-American. And again, it's all because Iran is the king of the South.
You alluded to it earlier, but this is not the first time that we've seen these revelations of collusion between Iran and Al-Qaeda, even though it is in more detail. But the fact that the CIA just released this doesn't take away the fact that they had this information, that they've had this information for quite some time. And it's just remarkable to me that the United States government has, under the Obama administration, and even the Trump administration to this point, has been fairly reserved in its going after Iran. But the Obama administration worked so hard to secure this deal with Iran, and it's just this storyline that we've followed for decades, really since 2003, when the United States deposed Saddam Hussein, just how active the United States has been in making decisions that have empowered Iran, and even to the point of trying to ally with Iran in spite of this this profusion of evidence showing that Iran has everything is completely against the United States and works against its interests at every opportunity. It just shows a tremendous weakness on the part of the United States that it wouldn't act on this intelligence that emerged in this document.
If people want to read more about this or even look at the whole wealth of articles we've written on this relationship between al-Qaeda and Iran, they can go to thetrumpet.com and just put al-Qaeda and Iran, if you can spell al-Qaeda, in our search browser, and then that will show you how long this relationship's been going on. And then, of course, you can request our booklet, King of the South.
Thank you for that, Brent. Back to China now. We've talked on this program quite a bit about how this Asian giant has been underwriting the regime of North Korea. But this week, after a long frosty spell, China agreed to restore bilateral relations with South Korea. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, this was on Tuesday that China and South Korea agreed to bury the hatchet and to finally move past what has been a really cold season in their relations. This dispute between Beijing and Seoul started when South Korea decided to install a United States defense system called the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD. And South Korea allowed the U.S. to do this because the South Koreans are very concerned about the North Korean threat and all the missiles that the North Koreans are firing, and they want America to be able to shoot down any missiles that could endanger South Korean people. But Beijing was very upset with the South Koreans for allowing the United States to deploy the THAAD system, especially since it's so close to China. China worries that the U.S. could use the THAAD system's advanced radar to peer across the Yellow Sea and to basically spy on China. So China heartily objected to South Korea's decision, and when the South Koreans ignored China and went ahead with the deployment of THAAD anyway, China started boycotting South Korea's tourism industry, its K-pop and other entertainment industries, its cosmetics, and several other industries that are heavily dependent on Chinese consumers. So this really inflicted some major damage on the South Korean economy. Tourism alone took about a $6.5 billion hit just over the last year. And all of this led to quite a long season of frosty relations. But now that season is over, and Beijing and Seoul say that they want to have a warm relationship once again. Both sides agreed on Tuesday that strengthening cooperation serves their common interests. So they said that they would boost all levels of cooperation and work to bring all areas back on a normal development track. China basically said, we still disapprove of THAAD, but we understand why you have to do it. And now South Korean President Moon Jae-in is planning to meet with the Chinese President Xi Jinping. That's scheduled for next week in Vietnam. And I think the timing of all this is quite interesting because it comes just days before U.S. President Donald Trump is heading to Asia for what will be his longest official visit yet and the longest visit to Asia of any U.S. president in decades. And Trump has stops planned for both South Korea and China. And the fact that these two nations are suddenly very chummy again could just weaken his position in any sort of negotiations quite a bit. Hmm. But the reason why this is really significant is because the Bible talks about the kings of the East, an end-time power block. And Ezekiel 38 gets into some of the details of which Asian nations will be part of this power block. And this chapter makes clear that Russia will really be the head nation. But it also lists in verse 2, it lists Magog, which includes the area that is modern-day China, as being in kind of a secondary leadership position. And then in verse 6 of Ezekiel 38, it talks about Gomer also being a part of this block. And Gomer, we've long taught, is the father of the modern Korean peoples and also the Japanese and some other Asian nations there. So I think that the fact that China and South Korea have now orchestrated this thaw and they're determined to work together a lot more closely, it could partly set the stage for these two powers to work together in this Kings of the East power block.
If people wanted more information, you'd send them to the Kings of the East booklet?
Yes. Yeah, the Russia and China in Prophecy booklet explains a lot of Ezekiel 38 specifically, and just the various nations that will be working together in this, and exactly how that massive power block factors into end time Bible prophecies. So Russia and China and prophecy would be an excellent place to go just to see about the significance of Asian countries working more closely together.
All right. Thanks, Jeremiah. Some economic news now as the Trump administration tries to pass tax cuts. There are questions about how to pay for this, and also other stories emerging of just how dire America's financial situation is right now. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, a few different economic stories this week, but the first is we had the 429-page outline of what Republicans are proposing as the biggest overhaul of the U.S. tax system for the 1980s was published yesterday. Now, this calls... This, you know, it cuts a lot of tax, and it doesn't really cut any spending. I think the total spending cut in the bill is $1 billion. So, you know, there's a lot of back and forth at this point with some sides saying, well, these tax cuts will pay for themselves. They'll stimulate economic activity. I think they certainly will stimulate economic activity, especially the corporation tax cut. I think that's one in particular that you get a lot of American money sits overseas not doing much because it's too expensive for American firms to bring it home. But there are still big questions about, well, is it going to stimulate economic activity that will reimburse the government through other taxes to cover what they're giving up in these tax cuts? And then also, well, then how long will it take for that to kick in? Mm-hmm. Because, of course, these are all long, that's a long-term effect, whereas the lost revenue is immediate. And America, you know, their cash problems are immediate in some way. I mean, ultimately, credit rating is good, and America's able to borrow fairly freely, but that could change without too much trouble at all. America has an absolutely huge national debt. And there are a few articles this week talking about U.S. President Donald Trump leaving for Japan this week. He's got a trip. He's visiting Japan. He's visiting South Korea. He's visiting China. He's visiting some other countries in Southeast Asia. It's going to be one of his biggest foreign trips of his presidency so far. And these articles were just pointing out he's also visiting America's biggest creditors. Japan and China are the top two by a long way that have been loaning America money. And that's got to be something that he's taking into account as he goes to these trips with these visits. With these tax cuts, he is going to be relying on these two powers lending America more money. As I said, even if the tax cuts ultimately bring in extra revenue, at least for the next couple of years, he's going to have to rely on those countries. And America's debt is just massive. So that's got to be something that he'll be thinking about as he's meeting with those powers. There's others that have been talking about the fact that American allies tend to be much more willing to lend to America, to buy U.S. dollars. And that's going to be something, you know, foremost among those are nations like Japan and like South Korea. Japan has just a huge reserve of American dollars. It invests a lot of its foreign currency reserve into American dollars. So he's going to be thinking about trying to keep all of these nations on side and the economic impetus from those nations. It's something that just really underscores how America's massive debt makes it dependent on the goodwill of other countries. And it's something, okay, there's a certain amount of mutually assured destruction in that it would cost China and Japan as well if they acted vindictively. But at the end of the day, it would cost America more. And it's a lever that America's giving to them. And as Jeremiah's been writing about, as Andrew has a blog this week as well, there have been shifts in the petrodollar, with Venezuela looking at moving away from the dollar. You've got Iran talking with Russia about moving away from the dollar, China encouraging nations to move away from the dollar. So there are signs that things could change very quickly for the United States.
You can go online to thetrumpet.com, and Richard has an article going up today, Donald Trump to Asia, Money, Please. You can read that. Certainly something that provides a little more context to what Richard covered very briefly there. We appreciate that, Richard. Well, we'll end with this story. This past Tuesday was Halloween. It's a bizarre holiday that celebrates ghoulishness and evil. Well, each year, unsurprisingly, there's a spike in crime and bad behavior associated with this holiday. This year was especially bad. For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, there were, well, we covered earlier about how there were 23 Americans injured in a terrorist attack on Tuesday, but then later that evening, there were actually hundreds of Americans across the nations who were shot or assaulted in crimes related to Halloween. As you mentioned, people have actually measured through the insurance reports that there's normally a 24% spike in property crimes on Halloween due to people who are being tricked, I guess, instead of getting the treat. But then also some of the bigger cities oftentimes experience a 50% spike in violent crime as well. One of our friends, Mr. Sean Welsh, sent in an email earlier this week with just several headlines he'd collected from across America that day. Headlines like Halloween Haunt Melee Yields 20 Crime Reports from Teen Mob. New Jersey Family Visiting Baltimore Haunted by Teen Attacks at Inner Harbor. Knockout Games Leaves U.S. Public Terrified After String of Random Attacks. And that that Knockout Games, a trend that's been building for a few years now. I mean, it's usually been a racially motivated thing where you'll go just punch the first person of a certain race that you see. But then this is something that's really come into the Halloween this year, too, where just have like these roving bands of thuggish teens just walking the streets and then punching the people as they go by. And like I said, this is something that I was just curious how far back this goes. I could find reports all the way back from the 1920s of just bad behavior being encouraged by the Halloween holiday itself, with, you know, people, you've already got teens out in the streets at night dressed in costumes. You're almost encouraging this type of thing. But it is something that in recent years has gotten worse and become just a really big problem in America every October.
So, Andrew, does this fulfill a prophecy of the Bible? What's happening here? Is there anywhere that you would send people for more context?
It definitely does fulfill a number of Bible prophecies about increased lawlessness and violence in the United States. And we already talked earlier in this program about our booklet, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that explains some of those in more detail. But I'd actually like to, just since we don't get to advertise it all that much, point to another booklet that our founder, Herbert W. Armstrong, produced, entitled God's Holy Days or Pagan Holidays, which it's a booklet that doesn't talk too much about prophecy, but it does talk a lot about the pagan origins of holidays like Christmas and Halloween, which I think a lot of our listeners will find really fascinating if they haven't read it already, just about just some of the practices in this holiday that have always been linked with pagan practices and evil practices, and just really help explain why even today so many of these horrible knockout games and crime waves happen on that particular day.
Well, we appreciate that. Andrew, we'll finish the program right there. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com. You can find that under the radio tab or just scroll down the page. You can click on today's program. You'll get links to all the articles and the literature that we discussed on the program today. Let me know what you think of the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Evan Asar. America believes in education. The average professor earns more money in a year than a professional athlete earns in a whole week. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.